Hello and welcome to this week's House of Comments podcast. My name is Emma Burnell and I blog at the Labour supporting blog Scarlet Standard. With me as always is Mark Thompson, who writes at Mark Reckons, a Lib Dem supporting blog. Hello Mark.
Hello.
And we are delighted that joining us today is Gawain Toler, who is the head of press for the United Kingdom Independence Party, or UKIP, as they're now better known and becoming very, very well known. Hello, Gawain.
Hello there. Greetings.
Okay. So obviously, we've got Gawain on for a particular reason. It's been Europe Week in Britain, or has it been Out of Europe Week in Britain? I think that's the question on everyone's lips. Gawain, over to you.
I suspect it's been... We don't know what's going to happen next in Europe Week in Britain. We've got a promise of a referendum in 5 years, which is no real promise for a prime minister who's unlikely to win the next election to grant that promise. So who knows?
And do you think this has been will be helpful to UKIP in the long term, or does it steal your chips?
I they're talking about shooting a fox. The only fox that's been shot is Liam Fox. There's been, as you've seen in the opinion polls today, there's been a slight decrease in UKIP's average position. It's been knocked back to about 10%. Well, if somebody had told me last year that I'd be on 10% now, or UKIP be at 10% now, I'd be delighted. And that's a knockback. Mm. I think what'll happen, you've seen a slight shift. That shift may deepen a little bit more. But as has happened in previous times when Dave has wrapped the Union Jack around himself, the disillusion will set in, yeah. And we will. And as people realise that the promises he's made, the demands for renegotiations, do not materialise and cannot materialise, given what they are, then the UKIP vote share will probably rise again. So it's obviously a big win for us in the sense that without us causing trouble and raising the issue of Brexit or in or out, then there's no way that Cameron would have offered it at all. So I think you get to bank the win and move forward.
OK. And Mark, what are your thoughts on how things move forward from here, particularly in terms of the coalition, your parties possibly being on different sides of this issue?
I mean, I think on that front, Cameron's covered himself by talking about what he'll do in the next parliament. So obviously that's not going to have a huge effect on what happens with the current coalition. I think... In terms of the referendum's going to happen in 5 years' time, I mean, Gawain said that it probably won't happen. He may be right about that. Cameron obviously has to win the next election and has to win it with a majority to be certain that he can push through what he wants. But I could feel John Prescott's famous tectonic plates shifting as it became clear what Cameron was going to say in this speech, because I think it has... spiked UKIP's guns to an extent. Oh, we could have all the metaphors in the world, couldn't we? Shooting foxes, pissing on chips, spiking
guns. Picking chips. I'll
go for spiking guns because I think that's probably a more apt metaphor, because I certainly don't think UKIP are now going to disappear as a political force. But I do think that now that Cameron has said that if the Conservatives win a majority, he will renegotiate and then put it to the country in an in-out referendum, I do think means that there will be leakage of UKIP support back to the Conservatives. And I think that's particularly true the closer we get to the next election, because one of the first things that UKIP spokespeople came out and said was, well, why do we have to wait 5 years? Why can't we have it now? I actually do think there are quite good reasons why we need to wait. I think Cameron is probably right that we need to wait until we've had a shot at trying to renegotiate. I don't exactly know what he wants to renegotiate, and I don't think it would be sensible for him to start showing his hand right now on that anyway. But I do think that by the time we get to May 2015, you're only talking about another couple of years. And I really do think that there will be people who might have thought of voting UKIP who will actually fall back in line and vote Conservative, because they know that if they want the in-out referendum, then they need David Cameron to be Prime Minister. And unfortunately, because of our terrible electoral system, It is, isn't it? Because in lots of places where people might
it
want
is
to vote
when it's
UKIP,
you, Mark.
Yeah, okay, it is when it's me. But in places where people might want to vote UKIP in substantial numbers, the effect that might have is to prevent them from being a Conservative MP, and therefore prevent Cameron from having a majority, and therefore prevent the referendum that they sorely want. So I do think it puts UKIP in an awkward position. But I do have to say, I agree with Gawain that they have made the weather on this, or they have certainly contributed quite strongly to the weather. And I wouldn't at all be surprised if Cameron wouldn't have offered this if it hadn't have been for all the work that they've done over the last few years. So I definitely agree with that.
Sorry,
Gawain, go ahead.
There's one thing that must be noted. There's two sets of elections before 2015. There's this year's council, mm-hmm. and there's next year's European and council. What's been very interesting, if you read things like Ashcroft's massive poll, he did this huge poll of UKIP supporters, which we couldn't afford to do. It was very kind of him to talk to 20,000 of them.
Yeah, God bless Ashcroft. I mean,
there's no way we could afford it.
To the opposition.
We get private polling paid by Tory peers. It's great. But very interesting. He came to a threefold, this is our campaign strategy against UKIP. Mm. And campaign strategy one was UKIP vote is a wasted vote. Campaign strategy two is vote UKIP, get Labour. And campaign strategy three was, what was it? We're the party of hard answers. They're the party of soft questions or something. I don't know, soft answers. The point being is when it comes to either the council elections or the European elections, those first two points are irrelevant under the D'Hondt system. Vote UKIP, get UKIP, not vote UKIP, get Labour. A UKIP vote isn't a wasted vote in a European election. So it seems to us that their sole interest, they've almost sold 2014 and the European elections as a dead loss. Mm. And they are only interested in the 2015 elections.
But now, do you not think, Gawain, that what Cameron has done could also affect what happens in the 2014 election? Because up until now, I've been labouring under the assumption that UKIP are favourites to actually win, to get the most votes and probably the most seats in 2014 in the European elections. I wonder if that might now not happen because of this.
I've for long felt that the most likely outcome is that Labour win and UKIP come second. Labour at 15% last time, that's absurd.
Yeah.
And they, and particularly whilst they're in opposition, in an election that people don't care about, the likelihood is they'll bounce back significantly. I can see UKIP increasing their vote share by 8 to 10% and still coming second, beating the Tory party, but coming second. Mm-hmm. Many of the people that you're thinking about, Mark, the ones that say might have voted Tory and would vote UKIP to keep the Tories honest and all the rest of it, will still vote UKIP in the European elections just to make damn sure that Mr. Cameron keeps his promises.
So I think you're right, Gwen, in a way that it seems to me that the Tories have largely written off the European elections and are heading for a purely Westminster strategy. But the way that you're talking sounds like you may be going the other way and are focusing the majority of your energy on the European elections and not then on the Westminster argument that. Would that be fair?
Yes and no. Yeah, we are focusing on the next election. After 2014, we'll be focusing on 2015. But the point being is, I think there's a 12,000 council seats on the same day as the European election. If UKIP do well in the European election, it'll raise the votes in our council elections. Mm-hmm. And once you start winning 5, 6, 7 wards in a constituency, that's when you start to have the foot soldiers. That's when you start to be able to fight a real campaign on the ground in Westminster, something that UKIP have never been able to do before.
Mm. Well, Gawain, on a kind of a more personal level, because obviously your position as head of press for UKIP, there are certain things I would expect you to say, and you've sort of said them. But on a personal level, presumably you must have joined UKIP because you passionately want to leave Europe, leave the EU.
I joined UKIP because after a couple of years working in the European Parliament, so I came to the conclusion that it was unreformable.
Right. So what you want, your kind of main political aim at the moment, is to get us out of the EU. Is that right?
It is part of a broader panoply, but yeah.
Okay. So from your perspective then, you want this in-out referendum, don't you? And therefore, you actually want Cameron to be Prime Minister after the next election, presumably, because otherwise you won't get it, because Miliband said he won't do it. He's the only other viable Prime Minister that we've got after 2015.
Well, I would say yes and no. I think Miliband ruled it out, and what was it? Within half an hour, half his front bench team was saying, oh, well, I didn't quite mean rule it out. I mean, when I said no in-out referendum, never say never, the hedging that took place within minutes of Miliband saying what he said, you should have seen John Cruddas's face.
I did see John Cruddas's face.
So I'm not at all convinced that all three parties, all three current main parties, will probably go into the next election with that in-out referendum pledge, like your own did, Mark, at the last election.
Yeah, well, you don't have to get me started on that, because I already blogged straight away saying that we should have backed Cameron's referendum. It would have been consistent with our previous position, because we said if there are any major changes, then we need a referendum. Well, going in and renegotiating half of what our relationship with the EU is surely qualifies as a change in the relationship. Yeah. So we should promise the referendum. But you know, at the moment, senior party spokespeople for the Lib Dems seem to be doing similar kind of hedging to what we've seen from Labour. Although actually not as bad as Labour, because I think Miliband was very foolish to come out and say instantly no, we're not going to promise a referendum. I think he had room to manoeuvre and he sold the pass on it for some reason.
Nobody expects an opposition 2 and a bit years ahead of the election to announce their policy. It's a very weird thing to have done.
It is. I mean, I agree. I don't think we needed to be as definite as Ed was in PMQs, and certainly we haven't been as definite since.
So I'm not convinced that.
Can I just ask a slightly different question, which is, are UKIP a single issue party?
No.
And would you then, if you have the referendum, whatever the result is, what happens then? Because I mean, from what I've been hearing from polling about UKIP supporters, Europe is not the only issue for them, and not the only reason that they've left, say, the Conservatives and found themselves a comfortable home in UKIP.
Well, firstly, you've got to remember that it's not just Conservatives. There are many who are none of the above, and about 20 to 30% are former Labour.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I'm saying the Conservatives, because I think that's probably the largest group.
Yes, but in no way exclusively so. I think issues such as choice and education, I share things probably with Mark on taxation issues, a fairer flat tax, cutting people out of getting people out of taxation altogether by bringing up the tax allowance.
When you say out of taxation altogether, what you mean is out of income tax altogether? Let's just make sure that we always clarify that.
Yes, direct income tax, in the sense that bringing the... I don't understand, and UKIP doesn't understand, why people on the minimum wage pay tax. This seems to us bonkers. If it's the minimum wage, surely you shouldn't be taxing it, because it's the minimum. It doesn't make sense to us. So we would move the tax allowance up to the level of minimum wage.
Okay, so will you, if you get this referendum and you pass it, or you don't pass it, either way, what happens? Do you continue to be a political force within British politics, or do you say, okay, well, we've achieved our goal as a party, we will now dissipate and go and find other things to do?
If the in-out referendum had been in the last 4 years ago, certainly, we would have probably gone home and tended our roses. Now, no. I think that the difference between our position on a whole range of issues, on education, on taxation, on a variety of environmental issues, energy issues, is great enough to have the more than just a core, but a growing and almost comprehensive set of policies that are distinctive. So no, as I say, I don't think we're going to go away. I would suspect if we won, then that would be one issue. If we were to lose an in-out referendum, then I think there'd be a certain amount of licking wounds, but we would continue to push.
So basically, I don't think we've covered how the referendum and its implications might affect UKIP, but it would be quite interesting. We don't have a Conservative here with us today, but what do we think the effect is going to be on the Tories and on Labour? I mean, for myself, I have to say I am completely sanguine about the politics of this. There are a lot of headless chickens attached to the Labour Party who like to run around on Twitter saying the sky is falling, the sky is falling. But I remember the last time that Dave got a little bit of a bump with the veto that wasn't a veto. And I just don't... I mean, the poll... from Comrades was remarkably low the time before, and thus his bump is not actually, that was probably an outlier, so it's more of a return to form than anything else. So I'm not worried, particularly in terms of the Labour Party having a problem with this, but I am interested in the Conservative Party and the effect it's going to have on them. And you know, my thoughts have always been that if you give a rabid dog a little bit of red meat, it doesn't stop it wanting to tear your throat out. In fact, it makes it a lot more likely.
And what a wonderful metaphor, Emma.
There you go. I think that that all David Cameron's done is giving them a little bit of red meat. What about you? What's your thoughts on that, Mark?
I don't think this is like the veto that never was, because it was pretty obvious almost straight away that that veto wasn't going to work and wasn't going to work the way Cameron was spinning. I think this is different because I think that in the run-up to the 2015 election, they can keep pointing to this. Any Tories or Tory supporters or potential Tory supporters who want to get out of Europe, they can just say, we're going to give you a referendum and you can make the choice. It helps to neutralise the issue. And it is, I mean, people talk about how this issue of Europe splits the Tory party. And I think it does, but not in the way that it did 20 years ago. So 20 years ago, you had genuine big beasts in the cabinet, people like Ken Clark and Michael Hess at the time, who were unashamedly pro-European. I mean, okay, Ken Clark is still there, but he's pretty much the only one in cabinet who is pro-European, and his powers are on the wane. I mean, he's pretty much yesterday's man now. You know, there isn't really anyone else in the cabinet who holds those views. And there are only a handful of Tory MPs who you could consider pro-European. The split is between the ones who want to come out completely and the ones who think that we need to renegotiate. So I don't underestimate the trouble that Cameron will have if he wins the next election and then he runs this campaign. But I think he'll pull a Wilson and he'll just allow members of his own party to campaign on both sides of the referendum. I don't know what happens after the referendum.
Has he not already told anybody who wants to be the cabinet that they can't?
Yeah, he has.
Really?
Yeah.
That's interesting. I wasn't aware.
It's a whippable offence. It's a sackable offence to campaign for an out if you're in the cabinet.
He's talking about, and he said that now, because the reason why I find that surprising is because I don't think even Cameron yet knows whether he's going to campaign for in. Because
no, he said he'll campaign for in. He's just convinced he'll get his renegotiation. He's not talking about what happens if he doesn't.
Yeah,
but he's going to campaign for in.
It's a strange position because he can't know whether he'll get what he wants. I mean, I suspect what will happen is what always happens with these things is that he'll come back and he'll pronounce victory and claim he has got what he wants.
Yeah,
whatever he gets.
Yeah,
but. Yeah, I'm surprised that he hasn't left himself the option of doing a Wilson Open, because I think that's the sort of thing that would have helped him keep his party together and on board, and then allow the splits to come to the fore during the referendum campaign on that specific issue, rather than have things bubble under. I don't really think it makes much sense to prevent people who really do want to come out of Europe from campaigning on that front. I think that's the kind of thing that could get people to start defecting and peeling away from his party.
Well, precisely. It's one of those things that obviously we're going to play with. If you vote Conservative, you vote for a party that's going to campaign hard and fast for a yes vote.
Well, and Mark, you're very aware of how hard and fast they can campaign in a referendum.
Yes, I was on the sharp end of... I wasn't officially involved in the AV campaign, but I was obviously a very strong supporter of it, and I blogged
One thing you may or may not have noticed, in today's paper, it's quite interesting, the Stuart Jackson sort of wing of the Tory party are already saying we've got to change the rules vis-a-vis Bulgaria and Romania and the open door that starts in January next year. Well, that's impossible on a whole series of grounds, not least that we've been told the negotiations start after the election and the door opens at the beginning of next year.
Yeah.
So it plays into your red meat idea there. The other thing that I think is extremely interesting and something you should be... I don't know if you saw Farage's piece in the Mail today.
I did, yes. Again, I'm quite sanguine about it.
Yes and no. I wouldn't be that sanguine in that, particularly in the north. If you look at the by-election results and things of this sort, in the Rotherhams and Barnsleys of this world, the things that we campaign on, be they Europe itself, be they the migration issue and the impact on particularly lower skilled, lower wage jobs, is something that matters deeply to people who have always considered themselves Labour. Our approach to grammar schools, and choice and education, the people who need that more than anybody else are not people like me with a nice public school education, but those who have no choice but to go to a pretty poor comprehensive school. The law and order side of things, the Human Rights Act side of things. There's a whole range of stuff that appeals, and it's not right or left. It appeals both to the sort of old Tory, but also appeals to old Labour. So, okay, be sanguine, but be warned.
I'm aware that there are some issues on which you campaign that have a resonance with Labour voters. There are also issues on which we campaign, although from a different perspective, possibly from this comprehensive girl's perspective. That's a good thing. But I just think that I think you're doing really well. And I think, and have written, that UKIP are positioning themselves as the place to vote if you don't want a Labour MP in the North. You don't vote Tory, and you no longer vote Lib Dem, and you are scooping up those votes very well. But I don't think what you're going to do is overtake the Labour Party in the North.
I wouldn't say we're necessarily...
Now, that's not complacency, because...
I'm not going to say we're going to overtake Labour in the North, but they people who could never bring themselves to vote Tory for historic reasons can feel reasonably comfortable in voting UKIP in those same same areas.
I can believe that, actually, because
yeah,
I know
no,
people.
Absolutely.
I know people, certainly members of my own family and friends from up north, that's where I'm from, who would literally never vote Tory, would never,
yeah,
ever vote Tory.
It would be an anathema.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, absolutely. But here's the thing, is that I think one of the biggest problems for Labour in the North is complacency. One of the biggest problems for Labour in the North is apathy. And actually, I'm quite happy for you to give us a bit of a kicking up the bum up there, because I really want us to pay more attention to what those voters need. So I think that the kind of community campaigning building that we're doing, and I know there's some really interesting work happening in some of the northern towns. I think Preston is one of the examples, is actually in some ways a response to the fact that there is a revived challenge coming from our right.
I wouldn't necessarily call it the right, but yes.
We'll have to agree to disagree on that one. I think we've probably covered Europe to death, or you might hope we covered Europe to death, Gawain. But I think we did want to stick with a certain amount of foreign affairs. This week we saw was Holocaust Memorial Day. Which is obviously in a very, very important event where we remember the disastrous things that happened in the last century, and why Europe is what it is now, what that started from, and the sense of solidarity that we all feel with the victims of the Holocaust. And I think that probably includes those people this week who have made some very intemperate and ill-judged comments. I'm thinking particularly of Lib Dem MP David Ward, who used this opportunity, I think you can probably see the air quotes around opportunity there, to speak out about the situation in Israel-Palestine in such a way that was probably unhelpful to his cause. Mark, would you agree with that?
Yes, I would agree it was unhelpful to his cause. I'd probably go further than that and say it was stupid and probably use some swear words as well. I don't think he's done himself any favours at all. I mean, I suppose if you read what he said, you can see the kernel of what he was trying to get at, but he did it in such a cack-handed, clumsy way that there was never any chance that people were going to focus on what he was trying to get at, because he used the term the Jews.
Yeah.
I mean, as soon as you're using terms like that, you can forget anyone listening to whatever substance you might be trying to communicate. It looks like an attack on an entire race of people, and a race of people who suffered horrendously at the hands of, you know, the hands of the Nazis during the Second World War.
And whose suffering we're remembering this week.
Exactly. I mean, it was wrong on so many levels. And then at first, I think he was trying to stick to his guns and say, I won't be silenced. But I think even he realised that he really did have to row back from that and apologise. He has apologised. I think it's been a bit of a qualified apology, and it's been a bit late
in the day. It's quite a qualified apology. Yeah. His apology is, it's almost, yes, I'm sorry, but I don't stand down.
Yeah, I mean, it was a classic sorry for any offence caused rather than actually sorry, which is a typical politician's apology, isn't it?
Yeah.
Indeed.
Yeah, I mean, I think Gawain and I both work in comms, and I think we both probably would just read the initial statement and just thought, thank, I won't use that word I was about to use, but thank God that's not one of us.
Yeah, and yes, I'm sure I had of comms read it and thought, Jesus Christ.
I mean, it's an incredibly sensitive topic. And I mean, I've written about this recently where instead of, I've been too scared. I've been blogging for nearly 3 years and I've been too scared to write about the Israel-Palestine situation, because in the same way that we've seen with some other issues recently, you put a foot wrong completely, completely unmeaningfully, and you are just absolutely pounced upon in the most extreme way. And I wrote a piece which said, I am too frightened to write my own opinions, my own thoughts, and I do not feel well enough informed to do this. But here are two opposing opinions from within the Labour family, and just ask some questions of two people who campaign on either side. Now, having said that, I think that it's very difficult, because if you're David Ward, you are probably thinking, oh, it's just what happens when you put your head above the parapet on this issue. Whereas I think, no, you didn't just put your head above the parapet. You put your head on the block and handed someone an axe. You know, you deserve to be vilified on this, but other people get vilified who don't deserve to be. And we have a really, really difficult way of talking about these issues in this country. And it becomes this extraordinary de facto argument. If you are on the left, you are seen as on this side. If you're on the right, you're seen as on that side. And there's very little nuance, and whereas it seems to me the issue is all grey area. Is this something that you're experiencing as a new part? Well, not new party, but a party experiencing new prominence, Gawain. Is this something that you're starting to find?
One of the things that's happened this year, we had a UKIP Friends of Israel group set up, and within a few weeks, we had a UKIP Friends of Palestine set up, which was fine. And people argue their cases and argue their cause. I think as an overall thing, we haven't. I think there's one town councillor who was slightly intemperate, and we asked for his resignation. He resigned forthwith and apologised profusely, who was, as I say, slightly intemperate on the issue. Not nearly as bad as Mr Ward, by the way, but still, nonetheless.
Was he the one who did it in poetry?
Don't recall that.
It was a council candidate in Kent, I think.
Oh, no, that's
his own
else.
Manifesto, that was last, some of which was in poetry.
That was something else entirely. Oh, what fun I had. but the I think the basic point is Israel is a democracy, and as such, whilst it often does things that we wouldn't, there's an interesting case that took place today. In the second biggest football club in Jerusalem, are for the first time ever planning to buy a couple of Muslim players, Chechens, no less. Mm. And there was a demo at the ground against this, and the police arrested people for chanting anti-Muslim chants. Mm. This is the Israeli police arresting Israelis for chanting anti-Muslim chants. It's not, as you say, it's not black and white. There are definitely, and the election results showing that it's all moved slightly to the centre, does not portray a simple situation. I think you're right in that there are boo words in British politics and in global politics, and anti-Semitism is one of those boo words. You point a finger and say anti-Semite, and that's it.
Yeah.
The fellow has no argument back. Just as you say fascist, and the person has no argument back, or racist, and there is no argument. And it is one of these boo words that is not designed to engage or understand. It's just designed to shut up. And that, I don't think, is entirely healthy for democracy.
Yeah, I think that's the reason why. I mean, as I say, debate is almost entirely qualified because debate is so difficult. If you don't know everything, you don't know anything, seems to be the view of those who immerse themselves completely within this and shout the loudest.
It makes the Schleswig-Holstein question look easy.
Yes. Mark, should David Ward have the whip withdrawn?
I don't know, really.
As happened with Jenny Tong?
Yeah.
Chris Davis got fired as the leader of the MEP group, didn't he, for the same thing?
Yeah, he did. I mean, I don't know. I suppose I kind of fall back on my my slightly more liberal view on this, that people should be allowed to have their opinions. I mean, you know, okay, he clearly did have an opinion that he was trying to express. He just did it in a terribly clumsy way that he really should have not done. Maybe he shouldn't have made the comments at all, but if he was going to make them, he needed to make them in a much cleverer way. I mean, I saw a description of how Shirley Williams responded to a question about Israel and Palestine a little while ago on BBC Question Time. And I mean, it was described as she went through the full panoply of explaining her history of, you know, her strong support for Israel and all the work that she's done. But then eventually she did criticize something that Israel had done in the context of Palestine. And she was able to do that because she had been so careful about how she'd caveated everything she'd said. I mean, Ward didn't do that. I don't necessarily think he should have the whip withdrawn, but I think he needs to be very, very effusive and clear about his apology, and he needs to shut up about this issue in future.
And if he doesn't?
I think the party...
And how far do you go before you should withdraw the whip?
I mean, I suppose it's different in different cases, isn't it? I mean, I think the real answer is that if the story dies down, then the whip probably won't be withdrawn. And again, I'm just trying to be honest here about how it works in politics. It's your Alistair Campbell's classic 11-day thing, isn't it? You know, if this keeps rumbling on and if it keeps rearing its head and if he does anything to further inflame it, he probably will have the whip withdrawn. I think at the moment, if it dies down, he probably won't, but he needs to keep his head down.
It's interesting. I mean, he's Bradford, isn't he?
Yes. Yeah. Does that have some particular pertinence because of...
Well, I would wonder if it's...
He has a large Muslim constituency.
Yeah.
He does have a large Muslim constituency, so it's probably not going to upset entirely those who vote for him.
Possibly.
I don't know. Well, I doubt he was thinking of that when he said it, frankly.
No, I mean, it may be why he became interested in the issue in the first place. You know, it may have been the trigger that took him into that campaign, but... I don't think he was thinking of electoral advantage.
No, I agree.
He said it. I think he was just being a dick.
A blithering idiot, yeah.
Yeah. Okay, so, well, we shall... I mean, Mark, just one final thing just to slightly pick you up on. Should the withdrawing of the whip be decided on the basis of how good or bad it looks politically, or should it be decided on the basis of whether that person is the right person to represent your party?
The answer is it should be the latter thing that you just said, but the real answer is it will be the first thing that you said. And again, I'm just trying to be honest about how politics works. When someone says or does something that causes massive offence and kicks up a massive fuss, I mean, you know, I'm thinking of something like what Aidan Burley from the Conservatives did a year or two ago. He went to some party that people were dressed up as Nazis, and they
paid for the party as well.
Yeah, well, that was the thing. At first, he was trying to claim he was almost a kind of innocent victim. He stumbled into the middle of this party and didn't realise what was going on. Actually, it turned out he booked the costumes and, you know, been responsible for organising the party. And they did some toast to the ideology of the Nazis or something. I mean, it was clearly just, you know, very, very, very bad taste attempt at joking, quotes. But, you know, he had to go. Well, I don't think they withdrew the whip, but he lost his position. I think he was like a PPS, wasn't he? And he lost that position.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, that was one of those situations where, you know, he had a particular role and he lost that role. He didn't lose the whip. I think, you know, had David Ward have held any kind of government position, he probably would have been fired from that position. I think withdrawing the whip goes a bit further in that they're suddenly, you know, out in the wilderness in the backbenches, and, you know, it's beyond the pale for the party at all.
It's
speaking of wilderness, the Tories withdrew it from Nadine simply.
Yes, quite. Imagine not nearly as bad as going on.
I'm a celebrity.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Like I say, different parties at different times have different reasons for withdrawing the whip from people, and I don't think you're ever going to find a consistent rule for when the whip should be withdrawn. In the end, it's what is politically most expedient for that party at that time. I think that's the truth.
That is the sad and unvarnished truth, absolutely.
Okay, so speaking of the unmentionables, people who are on somebody's list somewhere.
Am I on your list, Emma?
You're always on my list, darling.
Is it a good list, or is it like Nixon's enemies? I'm only clear.
It means you're important enough to be on my list.
Okay, let's leave it there.
One of the things that has been... brought up in Parliament this week was the blacklisting scandal. For those who don't know, this is a an organisation which helped, an organisation called the Consulting Association, which maintained a list of over 3,000 trade unionists.
Sounds terribly Orwellian, doesn't it? The Consulting Organisation.
It's brilliantly named.
The Ministry of Consulting.
Yeah. Well, they set themselves up. They kept tabs on over 3,000 trade unions and various very large, very well-known construction companies were using them to see who they wouldn't hire, who they thought might be troublemakers, particularly apparently those dreadful people raising possible health and safety issues, which might be why things like didn't have any deaths during the Olympics. This is
I understand some of the Olympic contracts were actually
some of the earlier ones were used on this blacklisting. The Olympics were fully unionized, and in fact the workers who led the Guard of Honor into the Olympic Stadium for the torch were largely unionized workers. There was even a union learning center at the Olympic site where people who worked on site and people in the local community could get access to adult education through the unions. So on the whole, what this was basically a way of saying we won't have none of you union troublemakers around here, which is wholly illegal, of course, and yet may well be continuing. What should be done about it, Mark?
My understanding is that there is an investigation into this, and I think Vince Cable said today that he doesn't think this is still going on, but I guess an investigation, a proper investigation, should be able to determine whether that's correct or not.
It's obvious that the Information Commissioner went in 2008, investigation closed it down in 2009. It is also, the Information Commissioner himself has basically said, look, the rules in which we were governing then allowed us to chuck a 5,000 quid fine at the people. Today, the new rules that have been brought in, we could chuck a 500,000 fine at them, but we can't backdate the fine because the rules weren't there. I don't think it's happening anymore. And it seems that there's this, let's have an investigation, let's have a review, let's have an inquiry. It's the age-old cry of the Labour opposition.
Don't you think in this case, Gawain, it kind of warrants an investigation? Because having people locked out of their own vocation...
It was entirely wrong, and it seems to have stopped. I think Cable is probably right.
It's believed that in September last year, 28 workers on Crossrail were sacked because they were found to be members of Unite. So I'm not entirely sure it has stopped.
I don't know.
And
if
that's why we need to investigate.
That's probably just anti-union thing.
What the blacklist is. It's anti-union.
Well, it wasn't just anti-union. It was a lot more than that. It wasn't just anti-union. Of the 600 GMB members that have applied, 147 have discovered they're on the list. There are other things going on. But I don't think that it is. I don't think this is something that is current. Cable said it, and as has the Information Commissioner, and they've gone to the GMB and other unions and said, look, bring us the evidence and we'll investigate. We need hard evidence. We can't just do it on a say-so. If there is that, yes, go ahead, do it, because it's wrong.
So there should be an investigation.
If evidence is brought forward that it is still going on.
You don't think there should be a proactive investigation? You don't think those people who may be suffering under this or concerned that they're suffering under this might be afraid to speak out? You don't think there are any precedents for that in recent years?
I think that the invitation from the Information Commissioner to the GMB is such that if somebody is concerned, they can go through the GMB or direct the Information Commissioner and that investigation will take place. What the invitation is.
That's what the invitation is, but I'm not entirely sure that the right messages, for example, Vince Cable saying openly, I don't think this is happening anymore, are the kind of messages that people who would want to make a complaint feel that they are going to have a good reception for that complaint. I think that it feels very similar to whistleblowing in several other different areas.
I would say that with the support of things like the GMB, I think you've got that support and backup anyhow to launch a proactive investigation into God knows how many different fields with precious little hard evidence that is going on now would be bloody expensive, an awful lot of time and hard work. Provide evidence, do it. Absolutely.
But Gawain, 5, 10, 15, 20 years ago, however long this has been going on for, if the question had been asked, is this going on? I'm sure people would have said, No. That doesn't happen. And this is one of those things. It's actually very difficult to prove that it's going on. It's only because they actually found a paper trail or an electronic trail of what had happened here that they can even prove that it did happen. I mean, I suspect quite a lot of the time this is all kind of whispers and, you know, he's not a good egg and no, we're not going to have that one. So I kind of wonder if the only way you're really going to get to the bottom of this is an investigation. I mean, this could end up being a massive scandal of something that has locked many, many thousands of people out of jobs over the years. I mean, they're talking about 3,000 at the moment.
3,000 at present, yeah.
Do we really think it was only 3,000?
Do we think it's... it seems to be pretty comprehensive. What is it, 40 firms were involved?
It kind of feels like this is just endemic. It's systemic. And
in the construction industry or beyond that?
Well, I'd be amazed if it was just the construction industry. Let's put it that way.
Yeah, I think I agree with that. I think it's very likely to have impinged into several other industries.
Right, if I think of my experience of the world of work, people do talk to each other. What's he like? What they've got now is you have to get permission to get a reference, don't you?
How do you mean permission?
Basically, if you're asking for a job, you give two references or three references, and the firm who is thinking of employing you has to ask your permission to use those references.
Right.
And this is one of the things the Data Commissioner has brought in to stop this happening again. So a further reference, other than a drink in the club, is going to be impossible. But a drink in the club isn't endemic. It's just how people are. I'm thinking of employing Fred. Oh, I wouldn't employ Fred. He's a troublemaker.
Yeah. I mean,
how are you going to throw the book at that?
That's a fair point, but it feels like it's a bit more than just that. I mean, clearly... Well,
and this case is a standout example.
Yeah.
And I hope that if any other examples in any other industry where it's endemic as this, will flush it out. Other people, other industries will say, hold on, and they hopefully will go to their union and say, oi. And then the union can take it to the Information Commissioner and the Information Commissioner will do its job, as it did in this case, and close the buggers down.
So, Emma, I'd just be interested to hear your thoughts on this, because obviously you're from a kind of Labour background and you've had involvement with unions in the past. I mean, what's your perspective on this?
Well, I think it's really, really hard. When you think of a union, what you think of are the people you see on television. The outspoken leaders, your Bob Crowes or your Len McCluskeys. But actually, most union members are just ordinary workers who are a member of a union because either they have the sense of social solidarity that they want to be part of that bigger thing. They do it to protect themselves and their rights at work. They do it to gain the kind of things that unions, through, for example, negotiation, are able to bring to people. Union reps, even. I mean, there's one rep for every, say, I don't know what the exact figures are, but if there's a couple of reps in a workplace, and then there are several other, that they represent a number of just ordinary union members. And these people work on, a series of different levels. I mean, you've got union members who are in very, very senior jobs. You've got union members who are in much, much more lower level, lower skilled work. If you are one of those people working in an industry which is insecure in terms of the way that it works, so, for example, construction, because once you've built something, it's kind of built. So you have to go from project to project to project. It is very frightening to put your head above the parapet. It's very frightening to be the person who speaks out, even with the support of your union behind you, because you know that when that person is next in the club and says, I want to employ Fred, you know that you are Fred. And you're going to be the person who, whether there's a paper trail or not, someone will say to somebody else, yeah, he spoke up, he's a troublemaker, don't get involved with him, he's horrible. That is hard to do. So if you're asking for all of this to proactively come from those people rather than us investigating and trying to find them, I think that's unfair. I think that's an unfair burden on the people, once again, at the bottom of the pile.
It does feel a little bit intractable, though. I mean, I kind of have to agree a little bit with what Gawain's just said. I mean, an informal chat over a pint. How are you ever going to investigate that, and what are you going to do about it? I mean, in the end, It is.
What you
nature,
have is proper recruitment processes yeah. that are actually clear.
Of course, but, you know, the quiet word down the pub, you're never going to be able to completely eliminate that, are you? And Fred, who decides he's going to speak out, can never be sure if he doesn't get a job the next time, if it's because he wasn't right for the job or because he spoke out. He'll never know.
And also, I mean, looking at from the boss's perspective, he wants people who are not going to cause trouble. Of course, it's not if he's employing, particularly in a smaller firm, if he's employing a couple of people. Is it in his interest to employ somebody who is known to be constantly carping on about this, that and the other? Now, it would be a very odd boss who would think, yippee, I've got a union organiser coming on my team.
Actually, I meet many, many bosses who work really, really well with their unions. And actually, good employers value decent quality work. And decent quality work is provided when people work in a healthy and a safe environment, an environment where they are not overworked, where they're not expected to work for too long, so they actually cannot provide decent quality work. And actually, it's the relationship between those unions and those good bosses that actually makes that work really well.
I wouldn't disagree that a healthy work management system is essential for a decent workplace. But as I say, particularly in smaller firms, in large firms where it is easier to where you have an HR department, where you've got all this stuff like that, these things are easier to handle. In a smaller firm, I think it's going to be impossible to chase that down.
I don't think it's impossible to chase it down. You just have to have a culture that makes it the exception rather than rule. And that's something we're not going to change overnight, but it's certainly not something we're going to change if we all just go, bosses, eh? Oh well. And yeah, just assume that this is one bad apple, like we assumed that Enron was one bad apple, or like we assumed that Jimmy Savile's just one bad apple. You know, there are cultures that build up around poor behaviours that can be changed and should be changed. And I think the first thing to do is recognise when we have a culture like that.
Yeah, and I should probably just finish by saying I do agree with that. I kind of recognise I sort of said something that might have sounded like the opposite. It's just I don't underestimate the scale of the task that you're trying to undertake here. I mean, I think where there's a definite audit trail, paper or electronic, that's fine. You can find that and that's proof. And that's the kind of proof will stand up in a court of law. I think beyond that, you are looking at trying to change the culture. And I think, you know, I think the kind of hiring practices, the way hiring practices have changed in the last couple of decades, in many ways, I think has been very much for the good. I mean, I run my own company and, you know, we get CVs in. Sometimes you don't even know what the gender of the person is. You usually don't know what the age of the person is. You can maybe, you know, surmise roughly what the age of the person is based on experience, but you don't know. And sometimes you get people who've got little experience who are a lot older than you expected. And, you know, that really just has no bearing on who gets to in front of you for interview. You know, very much we just focus on whether the person from the CV and you know, what they've done and what skills they've got, whether that's right for the job. And I know a few decades ago, it wasn't like that at all. And I think, you know, I think that's been a very good change. And I think the more that beds in and the more people recognise that's the right way to do it, perhaps this is a problem that eventually will recede. But I don't think it's going to go quickly, unfortunately.
I suspect that the whole what has happened in this particular instance will make a huge difference to the culture, particularly in the larger firms.
I'd hope so.
It looks like in the fullness of time, we will see some sort of class action that will cost some of these building firms multi-millions. And if anything makes them wake up, it'll be that.
Class action, class war, love it. Okay, I think we need to end on that note. An astonishing note of agreement between myself and Gawain.
I wouldn't go with class war.
We were doing so well, Gawain. Okay, I'd just like to thank Audio Boo for hosting the podcast, and also to thank Kevin McLeod at incomtech.com for the music. Thanks, as always, to Mark for joining us, and a special thank you to Gawain Toler for your brilliant contribution tonight.
Cheers.
Cheers.
Good night.